Retro.
Go.
Vital.
We're go fly.
Guidance.
Guidance, go.
Procedures.
Go.
Capcom.
We're go fly.
Launch control, this is Houston. We are go for launch.
This is Space Talk, a weekly program that highlights America's space program and what's new in space flight from around the globe. And now, with the past, present, and future of space exploration, here is Jim Behnke.
Greetings from Florida's Space Coast, home of the most skilled aerospace workforce in America. I'm Jim Behnke, and this is the August 26, 2012 edition of Space Talk, live on the air right here on WMMB. As years go by and we all get older, it's inevitable that the heroes many of us grew up with will pass on. Those of us who work within the space community have seen that fact hit close to home too many times during the past few weeks as we've been forced to say goodbye to former Kennedy Space Center Director Forrest McCartney and astronauts such as Janice Voss, Alan Poindexter, and Sally Ride. And now we live in an era in which the first human to walk on the moon, Neil Armstrong, no longer walks among us. Neil passed away on Saturday at the age of 82 as a result of complications from heart surgery he underwent about 3 weeks ago. Many years ago, when discussing the fact that there was no formal physical training program for the Apollo astronauts, Neil famously said something to the effect of, "I believe that every human has a finite number of heartbeats, and I don't intend to waste any of mine running around doing exercises." Well, Neil Armstrong didn't waste any of his heartbeats, that's for sure. Born and raised in rural Ohio, he was a naval aviator and then a civilian test pilot for NASA's predecessor organization, the National Advisory Committee for Aeronautics. He flew the X-15 rocket plane before becoming a NASA astronaut. He demonstrated his calm and cool demeanor in the cockpit as commander of the Gemini 8 mission, which featured the first ever docking of two spacecraft in orbit, and soon after the first ever emergency undocking in space, thanks to a stuck-open thruster that caused the Gemini capsule to spin so wildly that Neil and his co-pilot Dave Scott nearly perished. But Neil took charge, used a second set of maneuvering jets to stop the unwanted motion, and brought the Gemini ship home to a safe splashdown in the ocean. Later, just a few weeks before his Apollo 11 mission, Neil was training for the lunar landing in Houston with a strange-looking jet-propelled contraption nicknamed the Flying Bedstead. It malfunctioned and crashed in a terrible explosion. A split second earlier, Neil, keeping calm, recognized the impending disaster, ejected, and figuring that the remaining training exercises for the day were canceled, he calmly walked back to his office to catch up on some work, as though nothing had happened. And then, of course, came July 20th, 1969, when Neil Armstrong piloted the lunar module Eagle to a landing at the Sea of Tranquility, safely touching down with minimal fuel left, despite an overloaded computer and having to manually fly past a boulder-strewn area at the last minute. After all that, taking a two-hour stroll on the moon might seem almost anticlimactic, yet it was the historic moment of an age, witnessed by an estimated 600 million people on their televisions as Neil climbed down the ladder and stepped on the surface.
At the foot of the ladder, the LEM footbeds are only depressed in the surface about 1 or 2 inches, although the surface appears to be very fine-grained as you get close to it. It's almost like a powder. Ground mass is very fine. I'm going to step off the land now. It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
For those of us who are fortunate to be old enough to remember that day in history, the moonwalk was one of those defining moments in which we will never forget where we were. I was at my childhood home in Minnesota. It was a Sunday. My cousin Kurt and his family were at the house, and in preparation for the landing, Kurt and I set up my Major Matt Mason toys on the floor with the big moon station serving as a simulated lunar module and the hub of activity for Matt Mason and his space-suited buddies Sergeant Storm, Dick Davis, and Jeff Long. We also prepared my models of the command service module and lunar module so we could demonstrate to the adults what was happening at the moon as Eagle pulled away from Columbia to begin his descent to the surface. I very clearly remember my quandary in trying to determine exactly when the lunar module touched down based on what I was hearing and seeing on television so I wouldn't set my Eagle down on the floor until the real thing happened. A lesson that sticks with me every time I'm on the radio describing a launch. Never say liftoff until you see the rocket lift off. After the landing, the relatives went home. I took a brief nap. And then I was plopped on the floor in front of the color TV, wearing my red pajama bottoms and a white T-shirt, as Bubble Up Pop was poured down my throat to help keep me awake. When Neil stepped onto the surface, my dad took a picture of me watching the TV. Years later, in 1985, when I was a student at Embry-Riddle in Daytona Beach, I traveled to Tallahassee to speak to the National Commission on Space and met Neil Armstrong for the first time. After the session, alone in the hallway, I remember talking to him more about aviation and the X-15 than I did his adventures as an astronaut. I think he liked that, and we wound up spending some great quality time together. He was even more intrigued when I showed him that slide that my dad took and asked him to sign the border. He did so with a smile and told me that was probably the most unusual thing he was ever asked to autograph. Of course, this was years before eBay and his decision to stop signing things. That slide is the most treasured of my space mementos. I was fortunate to be able to work with Neil a number of times after that through a variety of connections in the years that followed, and I experienced his personality firsthand. Yes, he was private and a reluctant hero and shunned any notion of capitalizing on his place in history, believing truly and sincerely that he didn't deserve any of the attention, that his steps on the moon were the result of the hard work of some 400,000 people who were the true heroes of the space program. But in being private and keeping to himself, that didn't mean he was cold or aloof or snobbish. He was approachable, gracious, and always displayed the gentle, kind manners of a person who grew up in a rural Midwest setting. With Neil's passing on Saturday, the official statements and comments came fast and furious. President Obama said, "Neil's spirit of discovery lives on in all the men and women who have devoted their lives to exploring the unknown, including those who are ensuring that we reach higher and go further in space. That legacy will endure, sparked by a man who taught us the enormous power of one small step." Apollo 11 command module pilot Michael Collins said, "He was the best, and I will miss him terribly." Simple words that prove once again why Mike is one of my favorite astronauts of all time. Perhaps you've already read of it, but the best comment of the day, and the one that truly wraps up in one nice package all you need to know about Neil Armstrong and how you and I both should respond to the news of his passing, came from his family's official statement, released through NASA, in which concluded by saying, "For those who may ask what they can do to honor Neil, we have a simple request. Honor his example of service, accomplishment, and modesty, and the next time you walk outside on a clear night and see the moon smiling down at you, think of Neil Armstrong and give him a wink." Well, rest in peace, Neil Armstrong. We're going to miss you greatly. We're going to continue to talk about Neil through the rest of the program today. We're going to review a little speech that he gave a few years ago in just a moment. And then later on in the program, we're going to be joined by Apollo 15 astronaut Al Worden, who, of course, worked with Neil and all of the Apollo guys back in those great days of the 1960s and 1970s. Hey, by the way, this is the final Space Talk of Sunday. We're moving the program next week to Saturdays. We'll talk more about that in a minute as well. And we invite your phone calls and comments whenever you get a chance here. 321-768-1240, the number to call. SpaceTalking@AOL.com is the email address if you'd care to use that. We'll be back with more about Neil Armstrong in just a moment. I'm Jim Bank. You're listening to Space Talk on WMMB.
If you missed part of the show, catch the podcast, Space Talk, in the on-demand section at WMMBAM.com.
If it's happening in space, Jim Behnke is there. Okay, well, not in space, but he's all about it. This is Space Talk on WMMB.
And welcome back to Space Talk, everyone. 321-768-1240, the number to call to participate in the program today. Or you can also send us an email to spacetalking@aol.com. Yeah, we are going to continue talking about the passing of Neil Armstrong in just a moment. As we said later on in the program, we'll talk to Neil with Apollo 15 astronaut Al Warden. After the break at the bottom of the hour, we're going to spend a little time with one of the authors of a book about the restoration of the Apollo Saturn V moon rocket that is now on display at the Kennedy Space Center Visitor Complex. And I do want to spend a moment here remind you again of the change in showtime for Space Talk that we did talk about last week. Today is the final day. We'll be broadcasting this program on Sundays beginning next weekend, Labor Day weekend. Space Talk will be moving to 2 p.m. each Saturday, which was the original time slot for the show when we began 3 years ago. We'll be following the weekend favorite Kim Komando show. So I think the change is a positive one. I hope it means that more people will be able to tune in and listen and participate as well. Plus, it also means, most importantly, I won't have to miss any Minnesota Vikings football games while the Jacksonville Jaguar fans, I can't even pronounce the name right, it's how much I love the team, are listening to live coverage of their games here on WMMB. Once again, a reminder that Space Talk moves to Saturdays at 2 p.m. Eastern beginning next week. Now back to our discussion of Neil Armstrong. You know, the last time I spent any quality time with Neil in person was in Houston back in 2004 when he received the National Space Trophy from the RNASA group, the Rotary NASA group there, which is kind of like our Debus Award that we give here on the Space Coast each year by the National Space Club Florida Committee. Now, Neil's acceptance speech was an absolute classic, my favorite. I did capture it on a tiny cassette recorder and eventually transcribed the speech. Unfortunately, I don't have the tape anymore. But I do have the words, and I really do want to share them with you. Coming from Neil Armstrong, they are a great summary of our space program and show his own unique professor-like style of writing and delivery. The remarks were given just a few weeks after President George W. Bush, had announced the end of the shuttle program and the decision to pursue the vision for space exploration that would have us go back to the moon and then on to Mars. Neil's comments that night were the first public reaction that he had offered to the president's plan, and his comments, especially at the end, still resonate with truth today. I hope you'll enjoy it. Here's what he said. Neil Armstrong speaking. It's very special for me to have Christopher Columbus Kraft be the presenter for this award. We go back a long way, sometime back in the middle of the last century when we were both young engineers working with the National Advisory Committee for Aeronautics. The NACA was strictly a research agency with no operational role, but they were certainly trying to solve the problems of going higher and faster. The new jet engine permitted remarkable increases in aircraft performance, but their thrust decreased at altitude and their top speed was limited. Rocket engines had neither of these disadvantages. Americans take a great deal of pride in Robert Goddard's development of liquid propellant rockets. But the reality is, at the time, his work was ridiculed by some, including the New York Times, and only lightly supported. Most people could not see much practical use for a rocket. It didn't run for very long, had the world's worst fuel consumption, and it seemed to be prone on destroying itself one way or another. After World War II, the NACA, along with the Air Force and the Navy, pursued high-speed aerodynamic research using small rockets and rocket-powered experimental aircraft. The Army, with the help of the German Rocketeers from Project Paperclip, continued research using the V-2 as its derivative rockets. The possibility of artificial satellites was already widely discussed within the scientific community, but still it was a great shock to most Americans when, in October of 1957, Sputnik sailed across the night sky and people could actually watch it. The space age had begun, and we weren't a part of it. Americans were embarrassed, and for the first time ever, people began talking seriously about putting people going into space. 1.5 weeks later, researchers gathered at a long-planned conference to consider the best successor for the X-15, a hypersonic rocket-powered research aircraft, which was, at the time, still under construction. The competing configurations were a highly swept delta wing, a flat-topped lifting body, and a flat-bottomed lifting body. But Sputnik had changed the world. Hypersonic flight was being pushed aside in favor of sending a man all the way into orbit. All of the configurations that had been competing were too heavy to be lifted to orbit by existing rockets, products of the Cold War, which were designed to carry warheads over oceans. Max Faget and Paul Purser of Langley argued that if we were to get a man into orbit soon, the only choice, the only reasonable choice, was a ballistic shape lifted by an ICBM booster. The Soviets had reached the same conclusion. One obvious configuration was the sphere. It had no instability problems at any Mach number, and its aerodynamic characteristics were very predictable. But depending on its entry angle into the atmosphere, it might produce deceleration forces which are beyond human tolerance. Russians went the spherical route, and the Americans, using the work of Harvey Allen and Al Eggers at Ames, developed modified warhead shapes. And so it happened that the Vostok on the A-1 booster and the Mercury on an Atlas were created and launched, and human beings found themselves circling the Earth high above the atmosphere. Soviets were soon flying multiple crews, and we wanted to also. We wanted the ability to do more. The Gemini added onboard rocket propulsion so we could maneuver in space, and it had an onboard digital computer. Now, digital computers weren't so highly regarded in those days. They could be accurate, but they were interminably slow. This one didn't have any gigs or any megs. It had 4K of memory, no screen, just one 7-digit register for input and output. But Gemini crews could navigate and, for the first time, knew how to get to a destination without asking for directions. Using all this computer power, they took great pride in controlling their entry into their atmosphere, their trajectory, and being able to land precisely close to the ship that was awaiting them below. Despite this, I landed Gemini 8 near Okinawa, but my intended target had been the Caribbean. I doubt the record for missing the target will ever be broken. Apollo had a crew of 3 and more propulsion and more computing power, and Apollos, for the first time, were on boosters that were designed and built for them and had enough juice to leave Earth orbit. Apollo proved that humans were not forever a prisoner of Earth's gravity. We could leave our own planet and go to other celestial destinations, and Americans were no longer second best. Space stations emerged in the 70s with the Skylab and Salyut, and Apollo-Soyuz rendezvoused and docked in the 1970s, paving the way for international participation in later stations in here on the International Space Station. After Apollo, NASA conjured a grand plan to expand human presence in space and include one or more permanent terminals in Earth orbit. Craft to depart from and return to the terminal from various places in the solar system, and reusable craft to service the entire enterprise by shuttling back and forth between Earth orbit and the Earth's surface. Advocates were unable to persuade the establishment that that was all doable with the resources available, and only the last piece, the shuttle orbiter, was funded. The shuttle has now been operating for a couple of decades, with occasional timeouts for good reason. And although it never came close to reaching the original planned flight rate, and consequently the economies of scale, it has done a remarkable job of performing a very wide range of mission types. From time to time, new grand plans have been announced, only to decay and dissolve from an inadequate level of public support as interpreted by their elected officials. Now our president has introduced a new initiative with renewed emphasis on exploration of our solar system and expansion of the human frontiers. This proposal has substantial merit and promise. The success of that endeavor will be dependent on overcoming principal concerns of cost and risk. Our economy can certainly afford an effort of this magnitude, but the public must believe that the benefits to society deserve the investment. Noted the advancement of knowledge, the rate of progress is proportional to the risk encountered. The public at large may well be more risk-averse than the individuals in our business, but to limit the progress in the name of eliminating risk is no virtue. The success of the endeavor will also be dependent on the degree to which the aerospace community, all of us, government, industry, and academia, can coalesce their forces and converge on a common goal. So that's an 8-minute retrospective of the beginning of the space age. And the remarkable thing to me is that many of us here tonight happen to be living in a time when we could watch the entire process occur and be involved in a substantial part of it. So I'm extremely pleased to receive the National Space Trophy, and I'd like to thank all of you for being here and sharing the evening with the other award winners and with me. Thanks. Well, those were Neil Armstrong's words from 2004, and they remain just as valid today. Well, here at the bottom of the hour, we're going to take our usual 5-minute built-in hold and let you get caught up in the latest news, weather, and sports. When we come back, we'll talk about the restoration of the Apollo Saturn V out at the Kennedy Space Center with the author of a recent book about the project. And we'll be back with Al Worden later in the program to talk more about Neil Armstrong. I'm Jim Bank. You're listening to Space Talk on WMMB.
Space Talk is back in a minute. Call Jim now at 768-1240. On the web at WMMBAM.com.
And welcome back to our second half of Space Talk on WMMB. Our phone lines and online inbox are open for your questions or comments. The phone number 321-768-1240. The email address is spacetalking@AOL.com. Well, earlier this year, a new book was published called The Final Journey of the Saturn V, and after reading the small 128-page book in one setting, I got to admit I was a little disappointed. Many of my fellow space cadets who do book reviews were very disappointed and were quite unkind in their choice of words in reviewing the book, very unfortunate in a way. The book was supposed to be about the restoration of our Saturn V at KSC, which had sat outside for years next to the vehicle assembly building, and really was nearly ready to fall apart before it was rescued, restored, and moved into the beautiful new Apollo Saturn V Center. In terms of the book, you know, only a very few pages were actually dedicated to that part of the story. The rest of it was sort of a survey of the history of the space program with a focus on the Saturn V's development. Now, it did have some errors and I think some questionable inclusion of some content, and it did commit the cardinal sin of misspelling the name Spatial Endeavor. And again, I have to admit, I was kind of ready to toss the book away and forget about it. But then I did have a conversation with one of the book's authors, Andrew Thomas, and I learned some of the story behind the story of the book. And I thought that their experience and their views were incredibly interesting and very much worth sharing with everybody, because I think it makes an interesting point that we all need to be aware of. Joining us on the phone is one of the co-authors of the book and the man who was responsible for the restoration of the Saturn V itself, Paul Thamarias. And, Paul, we welcome you to Space Talk, and thanks for being on the show today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be there, and I'd like to say that our hearts go out to the family of Neil Armstrong.
Well, we appreciate that. You know, it's kind of fitting we're talking about the Saturn V. In fact, I planned to talk about this even before we learned of Neil passing away, and of course, he took the big rocket ride to the moon with his colleagues. Paul, before we get into the story of the book, in our moments that we have together, talk about the restoration. You did an absolutely fantastic job, your team and your company, in restoring that thing and safely moving it from where it was to where it is now. And could you talk a little bit about it after all these years? What stands out as your chief memory of that whole effort?
Well, the chief memory was we brought everybody down from our offices in Ohio to do the project, and it was a team effort. No single person was responsible for everything. The specifications the Smithsonian put together for 5 years, we kept tweaking as we restored the rocket, because it was like discovering a corrosion that nobody ever thought about was occurring. It sat out there for 15 years in front of the VAB building, and we worked hard in replacing pieces that were gone, replicating pieces, the corrosion was mitigated as best it could with the technology we had 15 years ago. And it was truly an effort that everybody put out, and everybody was happy about doing the project.
You know, I remember when the stages were starting to be moved, and we all held our breath to whether or not they would actually make it. Were you pretty confident that at that point that they were going to travel safely?
Definitely. We took a lot of the pieces and parts apart and mitigated the corrosion, then put an epoxy penetrant, low molecular epoxy on all the interior areas that were accessible to us that would preserve the not only the exterior of the rocket but the interior of the rocket. So it's going to be there for a good 100 years or so.
You know, there's famous stories about NASA losing the blueprints to the Saturn V, and, you know, I don't know if that's apocryphal or really true, you know, but I think the question is, how much of the documentation did you need to go do your job, or was it pretty much compare pictures and make it look the same?
No, what we did, we put an ad in the Space Coast Times for any engineer that had material on the rocket itself, because what I understand, when the Apollo program was over, all the documents were never collated. They were just taken to a warehouse in Alabama. So we must have had about 30 different engineers with their personal files come in and share those with us. And it was great that those people came in to do that. We got a lot of knowledge from them, a lot of interesting stories about their times at the Cape. And that helped us immensely to put the rocket back into its original form and shape.
You know, we're talking about the book and its format, and I'll ask you a little bit more about that in a minute. I wish there had been more stories. There is a great story in the book about the restoration, about one day finding an unusually colored liquid that you weren't sure what it was or whether it was toxic. Could you talk a little bit about that?
That's when this purple fluid came out. You know, of course, the way NASA's hazmat was out there with their aluminum suits and ready to take us out of the area, and what it was berry juice that was coming out of the rocket from the birds storing food within it.
It's incredible.
There are a lot of little caveats like that happened along the way. One of the most interesting one was when we laid the American flag out on the rocket itself. It didn't, you know, the dimensions the Smithsonian gave us didn't look like the photographs. You know, what's going on? You know, what's going on? What's going on? So we hired a vexillologist. Now, a vexillologist is a doctorate of flags.
Okay.
And found out that Congress changed the actual dimensions of the flag because of the textile lobby. Anything that looks like an American flag can be an American flag after, I think it was 1972. And the actual dimension of the flag is a proportion, 1 to 1.9. So once we laid it out with that proportion, it looked like the original photograph.
And when we see the Saturn V in the facility now, how much of that exterior work, the coloring, the painting, the final detailing, did you do or were responsible for? I've never really been clear on that.
Yeah, we did all the final detailing. It was from the original photographs that we got of Apollo 11, because it was supposed to emulate Apollo 11 at the Apollo Center.
Yeah, and that's interesting because, you know, you look at that rocket and there's so much color on the rocket, brightly colored lines, and you think, well, they must have painted that up just to make it look pretty. And yet, you know, my understanding is that's if you were up close to that rocket, that's what it looked like.
Yeah, for example, on Stage 2, if you recall, the aft end has all those exposed wires.
Yeah.
We duplicated the original colors of the wires. When they painted it a couple times prior to us depainting the rocket, when it was sitting out there in front of the VAB, they coated everything white, and we meticulously removed the coatings and layers to see the actual colors. And those were the aft end, the oranges and the blues were the actual colors. The wires on the rocket itself.
Now, once the facility opened, how often have you been able to get down here and take a look at your work?
I come down at least once a year. 5 years after the project was open, we went back in to see what was going on with any corrosion within the interior areas of the rocket, and there was no corrosion that had started.
So it's in good shape, and like you said, it could last 100 years.
Oh, easily.
Wow. And it's a great testament. When that one moved, of course, then I think there was a lot of attention on dealing with the other two Saturn V displays. I know both Huntsville and Houston, Johnson Space Center, and Marshall have done some more work. Were you able to be involved in any of that work, too? Or?
Well, it's kind of an interesting story. We found a system that worked very well, and since we did that system, the Green Initiative has popped its head out, and we wanted to use the same exact products and technology we had because it standard the test of time. Well, NASA had another idea, and they wanted to go with waterborne products that were in their infancy then, and we just refused to do that to those historic artifacts.
Sure. Yeah, I remember when you were doing the work on the Saturn V, all the big tents and all the effort to make sure that while you were working all these chemicals, it was all clean and you weren't blowing everything on everybody's cars and all of that. Paul, talk a little bit now in our couple of minutes left about the book itself. Your colleague Andrew was telling me that it was a tough sell, it was a hard thing to get out, and then ultimately, it served a very special kind of niche in space history. Can you talk a little bit about your experiences in getting that book published?
Well, it was a five-year development of doing the book, and a lot of hours on Andrew and I talking back and forth on what the purpose of the book was, and it was to engender the 70% of the population that wasn't alive when the rocket took off. And we've lost so much of that history and the glory days of the U.S. being in the forefront of technology, and we wanted to inspire the youth with the book to make it an easy read. Tell them the story that NASA has never brought forth to engender the youth, to get them inspired to want to be in the engineering fields and in the technology field. Yeah.
Well, I think the book is a great kind of primer, opening salvo, if you will. Read that book and read so many others. And again, Paul, we're wrapping up with you, but thanks again for your work down here. And next time you come down, I'd love to meet you and go stand underneath that thing together.
Great.
Thanks again, Paul.
You have a great day.
You too.
Thanks.
Now, take care. Appreciate it. Okay, there goes. Hey, by the way, the book called Final Journey of the Saturn V, it's worth a quick read. It absolutely is. Pick it up if you get a chance. Well, if all goes well, Al Warden from Michigan from Apollo 15 will join us next. Plus, we'll take a quick look at the local launch forecast. I'm Jim Banky. You are listening to Space Talk right here on WMMB.
If you missed part of the show, catch the podcast, Space Talk, in the on-demand section at WMMBAM.com. Now, back to our own mission specialist, Jim Banky.
Welcome back to Space Talk, everyone, as we do continue to remember Neil Armstrong. But first, I want to remind you that NASA's Radiation Belt Storm Probes mission is retargeting a launch on its Atlas V rocket for early this Thursday morning at 4:05 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time. Technical and weather-related problems have kept the booster on the ground so far. Launch team is now waiting out the passage of tropical storm, soon to be Hurricane Isaac, before trying again Thursday morning at 4:05 in the morning. I'll be on travel this week, but if we can work out the logistical details, we will try to bring you live coverage of the launch. As we talk about Neil Armstrong and what is kind of a sad day here, joining us on the phone from his summer home in Michigan, our good friend Apollo 15 astronaut Al Warden, who, of course, knew and worked with Neil. Al, how are you doing today?
Hey, doing fine. Jim, how are you doing?
Well, good. I'm glad to hear you up and about and having a good summer. Tell us, first of all, how did you hear the news, and what was your reaction?
Actually, I got a call from my daughter. She had heard it on CNN, and that was the first I'd heard about it. And that was like a sledgehammer blow.
I can imagine.
Just did not comprehend or expect anything like that to happen.
Yeah, I guess he had some heart issues and some surgery.
I guess
and some
he
complications.
Had some open heart surgery here a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah.
And obviously there are some complications from that.
When something like this happens, Al, how do the Apollo guys, you know, is, do you have your own little network? Do the phone calls start happening, or have you all pretty much gone your own way?
No, I think, we're all, I got to say, we're all kind of trained for stuff like this to happen.
Yeah.
You can't go through the test pilot world without losing friends.
Yeah.
And you realize that it's a part of the game. Now, you know, we've gone way beyond that now, and we're older, and, you know, guys are dying from old age. You know, it's kind of funny. I was adding up. We had 12 guys who walked on the moon. 8 of them left. We had 6 guys who took them there and waited for them and brought them back home, and we got, like, 4 of those left.
Yeah.
You know, the ranks are getting thin, and I think we're going to have to expect more and more of this to happen in the future.
Well, it's inevitable. I mean, life goes on. That's the way God made it. And
yep.
And we can deal with that. But it's sad to hear of Neil leaving, of course, and you know, everyone else. I guess what I want to ask you is, you know, talk about Neil Armstrong, what it was like to work with him back then. Was he the man back then that we all think he is today?
Absolutely. Neil was a unique individual. Very, very nice guy. Always was very nice to everybody. I got to know Neil better over the past 4 or 5 years than I ever had before because he was so busy when I was there.
Yeah.
But since I've started working with the Astronaut Scholarship Foundation, I've had quite a bit of interaction with Neil, and I've always found him to be a very charming, nice person, one who was would not let anybody take advantage of him particularly. Kind of in the last few years, the one thing that Neil would do is he'd go to all the anniversaries of the various flights.
Yeah.
And give a little talk, and of course you've been there too. And they were always very, very nice talks that he would give. He was always very supportive of the guys. He was not supportive of things that were aimed at commercialization of what he did.
Yeah.
So I think Neil was always very reticent to get involved in anything that smacked of commercialization or of making money because of what he did. Now, between you and me and the gatepost, you know very well that Neil probably made a lot of money because of who he was, but he did it by being on the boards of companies, of doing his own thing, of teaching, of giving lectures, of that kind of thing. But you never saw him out there in the commercial market selling things.
Yeah.
And I think that's a tribute. That was a wonderful thing about him. I place Neil Armstrong in a, you know, on a pedestal. He was my role. He was a model. He was an icon. A great, great guy, and he's up there with Charles Lindbergh and, you know, all those who did extraordinary things, Jimmy Doolittle, those kind of people. Neil is in that category of people, and I don't think anybody else touched him.
You know, he grew up in rural Ohio. You grew up in rural Michigan, and we
yep.
talked when we were on the show a few weeks ago about your book, Falling to Earth.
Right.
Something about that background, you know, when Neil is private and quiet and introspective and very humble, I mean, those were the people I grew up with in rural Minnesota as well. There's something about
yeah.
that background. And I don't think people in the sophisticated city understand that Neil should have been out there, you know, pounding the pavement and doing all those things. It just wasn't his style.
No, it was not his style. It was not his background has a lot to do with the way we do things in our lives. Neil grew up on a farm. I grew up on a farm. You can't live on a farm and take care of animals and be responsible in a very heavy way for living things, living creatures, without being pretty humble about what it's all about. And, you know, you grew up on a farm, and you're not out there politicking. You're just doing your job. And I think that's Neil's background. As a matter of fact, if you check, you'll find that the early members of the space program, the Mercury group, the Gemini group, the Apollo group, all those guys, a large percentage of them were first sons or second sons. When the oldest child was a daughter, they were all kind of Protestant, Midwestern background, all came out of this kind of the same sort of barrel. Obviously, there are exceptions to that, but Neil was part of that.
And certainly other upbringings and all that, to be politically correct, are just as valid. But, you know, there's something about that mold and something about that comes out of that. And Neil was a great example of that. And Al, you are too. What's next for you? You coming back down here anytime soon?
Yeah, coming back down next week, Jim. We're in a transitional mode up here in Michigan. We sold the house that we're in on the golf course, and we're moving to a lake, which is about 30 miles south of Grand Rapids. We're building a house there, which is just getting started now. So we are closing down this house and coming back to Florida for the winter, and hopefully come back up here in the spring to a brand-new house.
Well, we'll see you down here soon. Just wait a week before this tropical storm gets away, because it's raining on your
house
right now.
I understand that. Is it a hurricane yet?
Not quite, but I'm sure by this evening it will be. So, hey,
well,
Al, thanks.
I understand the West Coast is getting it, and that's fine with me.
Well, okay. Al, thanks for spending time with us today, and best of luck. We'll talk to you soon,
you
okay?
Take care.
Thanks,
talk
buddy. Bye-bye.
Soon. Yeah.
Well, there you go. Al Warden, one of the best. Hey, as we move to Saturdays at 2 p.m. from now on next week for the Labor Day weekend, we will present a special Best Of edition of Space Talk. We'll feature a replay of our July 1st program, in which we celebrated the 50th anniversary of the Kennedy Space Center with three of the great ones, George English, Bob Seek, and Roy Tharp. Again, next week, a Best Of edition as this program moves from here on out to Saturdays at 2 p.m. following the Kim Komando Show on WMMB. Well, believe it or not, that's it for today and the special tribute to Neil Armstrong. Appreciate everybody listening in. Space Talk is a production of Myla Solutions and is brought to you thanks to the generous help of our supporting sponsors, Space Florida, Boeing, Abacus Technology, SpaceX, United Launch Alliance, and Lockheed Martin. My thanks to Sean Williams, as always, for manning the op station for today's program. Again, join us next Saturday at 2 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time for another hour of Space Talk. Stay tuned now as WMMB presents a weekend edition of The Best of Bill Mick Live. And if all goes well, we hope to talk to you again early Thursday morning with live coverage of the Atlas V rocket launch from Cape Canaveral Air Force Station. So long now.